This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Democrats are insane, and they're communists, and people hate them. We'll talk about that tonight. We're going to talk about immigration. How far are we away from mass deportations? All that, Carol Roth on the economy, and more coming up on I'm Right. Well, let's do some good news, kind of. Some good news, because there's all kinds of things we can feel a little dour about right now. Isn't that a great word, dour? But people hate Democrats still. They hate them. Now, I know the Republican Party, everyone's souring on them, and the unfavorabilities, and the midterms look like they might be rough, and I understand all those things, but people hate Democrats because they're freaking the spawn of Satan. You see this on CNN?
Let's just take a look at this. Net favorability. Party ahead at this point. Midterm of years with the GOP president. In 2018, Dems were up by 12. In 2006 on net favorability. Which party you like more? Dems are ahead by 18. Republicans are actually ahead on net favorability at this point by 5 points. So Democrats are just simply put running behind their previous benchmarks, and they need to be running well ahead of them if they want to take back the United States Senate.
People hate Democrats because Democrats are evil. And here's the sad thing about that, though, as it pertains to the midterms and other things that are coming. The sad thing is we are not governed by you, meaning high-informed voters, voters who pay attention to things. They're not the ones who actually decide elections. It's such a sad state of affairs. You know how you're going to vote in the midterms, so do I. It's the low-info voter who actually is the swing voter. Well, the low-info voter, by some kind of miracle, I don't understand. Apparently, they all have amnesia. The low-info voter forgets how soulless and evil and destructive Democrats are after he gets done voting for a Republican. So the low-info voter goes out in a state like Virginia, for instance. Virginia had a Democrat governor, and of course they destroyed everything in the state. And then Virginians woke up one day and said, gosh, we're tired of that. Let's go vote for a Republican. They voted Glenn Youngkin in, and Glenn Youngkin made a bunch of things better. But still, because everything didn't become perfect overnight, low-info normie idiot ran to the polls again and voted for Abigail Spanberger. And now I see things like her favorability rating plummeting under 50%. They're already mad at her because she's doing what? She's doing the most predictable thing in the world, governing like the communist she is. If we only had high info people voting in our elections, we wouldn't have to do this swinging back and forth thing all the time, and then we're governed by communists. Did you see, speaking of governed by communists, it's something to watch it play out the exact same way everywhere they've ever held power, and this is what happens. They get into power, and then they grab all the scum who has supported them, and they put those people in high positions of power. Here's the one, Mam Donnie.
And while today's true cost of living measure confirms that the affordability crisis touches every corner of our city, we know that these effects are not applied evenly. So often, it is Black and brown New Yorkers who are hit the hardest. This preliminary racial equity plan is the first step in developing a whole-of-government approach to tackling that reality. It is a plan that lays out these first steps to solve decades of neglect and discrimination, and it places the work of 45 city agencies within a singular framework.
You know what it is. Zohran Mamdani is a communist. His followers, his loyal followers, they're all communists, the scum of the earth. He's going to now, and has already, put them in critical positions of power in New York City. And what do communists do with power? We've talked about it 1,000 times. They only do 2 things. Power is never used to help the people or serve the country or the city or whatever. That's, communist doesn't think like that at all. The communist does 1 of 2 things with power. He rewards his friends and he punishes his enemies. The racial equity plan will be carried out by the communists he puts in positions of power, and it will do, well, something quite simple. It will loot the people he views as enemies, and hand out cash to people he views as friends. How's he going to pay for this plan? Well, here he is.
Amidst being in the wealthiest city in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, we already see an exodus of working and middle-class New Yorkers. So I don't have a hesitation in asking those who make the most amount of money in the city or the most profits in the city to pay a little bit more so that everyone can actually stay in this city. It's also something not just about justice or the ability for working-class people to live here. It is also actually about ensuring that corporations can continue to attract the top talent to this city. Because in a city where childcare costs more than $20,000 a year, I've heard from corporate leaders about how difficult it is for them to attract individuals who would work at their companies but want to raise a family, because you could be making $300,000 a year and you will feel that $20,000 a year because of the fact that we have allowed for the absence of affordable childcare to become reality here in this city.
They dress it up, all the flowery language in the world, but they reward their friends. They punish their enemies. That's what happens when you vote Democrat. You see this guy, Abdul El Sayed, running for Senate as a Democrat in Michigan. Yeah, he's out there campaigning with a guy named Hassan Piker. Okay? Who's Hassan Piker? Oh, this is who he is.
Well, my understanding is that the property owners who have properties there choose just not to rent it at all.
Yeah, kill them. Kill those motherfuckers and murder those motherfuckers in the street. Let the streets soak in their fucking red capitalist bloods, dude.
Look, that moron swing voter. Maybe he's going to have a hissy fit at the polls. Put these people into power. Then we'll all pay. They're all just demons, dirty thieves. You see Ayanna Pressley, what she said?
Eviction is an act of violence, and we have to do everything to prevent it. It is devastating for the families. It degrades the health of communities. There is great stigma associated with it. It affects your credit score. Housing is a human right. It is a predictor of health outcomes. It's essential for social and economic mobility. And so many people, when they receive a notice to quit or to vacate their homes, usually because of non-payment, because wages are not keeping pace with inflation, they don't know their rights. And a lot of times they will just accept that notice to quit and leave. And so my legislation is making sure that they have access to legal counsel, because we have found that when tenants know their rights, when they have access to legal counsel, we can keep them safely housed.
They're just thieves, and they destroy every single thing they touch. Now, rumor has it, the prediction markets think the Democrats are going to take the United States Senate. We don't know that yet, but might be a rough November for us. You get it. Who's going to be the Democrat senator from Maine? Oh, here he is.
There is structural power in the Senate to deal with the Supreme Court. It's going to matter. It's going to require us to get the majority. But at that point, I very much think that we need to be exercising ethics oversight over the court. If we held Supreme Court justices to the exact same standards we hold federal judges, there is a compelling case for the impeachment and removal of at least two. But to make that happen, we need to elect people to the Senate that want to wield power like that, who understand that power matters, that it's real, and you can...
This is what happens when you give these people power. Don't think they're kidding either. That's what's at stake. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but we're right. We're going to go talk to... We're right. I'm right. We're going to go talk to Theo Ward in a moment. Before we talk to Theo, let me talk to you about something that's right, and that's a male vitality stack from Chalk, or a female vitality stack. I'm talking about your energy levels, talking about your mood. I want you feeling good all the time like I do. Do you want to feel good all the time? Natural herbal supplements will get you there. 20% increase in your testosterone in 90 days. You'll feel like a new person in 3 months. Now, what are you going to feel like in a year? I'm on year 4. That's how much of a believer I am. Go to chuck.com/JesseTV, get a subscription, and turn your life around. We'll be back. Well, I have exciting news. Do you remember the SAVE Act? You know, just kind of show ID to vote, kind of make sure it's just American citizens voting. Well, that's clearly dead. But we have new immigration legislation out there. I'm sure because they're interested in saving the country, Republicans are getting ready to lock down the border, maybe even deport some more people. Let's ask Theo about it. Joining me now, Theo Wold, former assistant attorney general, knows quite a bit about quite a bit. Hey, Leo, what is the, hold on, I want to make sure I get this right. The Dignity Act sounds great.
I guess, Jesse, the one thing that Congress is always uniquely capable of doing is providing some, you know, interesting acronym or some cute title to an otherwise total piece of crap piece of legislation. So the Dignity Act, as designed, would provide amnesty to all of the illegal aliens who entered the country prior to Joe Biden taking the presidency. Put an asterisk by that, though, for just a second. So any illegal alien who entered the country before Joe Biden, any illegal alien married to an American citizen, any illegal alien who is currently making their way through military service, and any number of short-term labor visas would certainly qualify under this act for green cards. So all of your international students who are coming into the United States, they'll finally, under this proposed bill, they would finally get their green card stapled to their diploma, as Jeff Flake, the former senator from Arizona, and others used to say years ago. So all of this and the asterisk that your viewers and your listeners really have to pay close attention to is it's supposedly for those illegal aliens who came into the United States before Joe Biden. But that's just a debatable proposition. That's an arbitrary time clock that will be litigated. Most illegal aliens then will flood the courts trying to, you know, provide some kind of documentary evidence that they entered the country before Joe Biden. So essentially what the Dignity Act does is it provides legal status to every illegal alien who has entered the country in the last 40 years.
Okay, this is just a Democrat bill though, right? Surely Republicans wouldn't be involved.
Yeah, sure. I mean, why would Republicans that control the presidency, both chambers of Congress, the majority of state gubernatorial mansions, and the United States Supreme Court, at least by Republican appointees, why would they do this? Certainly, they're not involved. Unfortunately, Jesse, 20 Republicans have co-sponsored this proposal in the House, and two of the proposed bill's lead sponsors are Republicans, Representative Salazar from Miami and Representative Mike Lawler from New York.
That's absolutely wonderful. Now, I have to ask the question that matters most. It's not going to pass, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, views on this have hardened pretty significantly over the last few years since we've had amnesty proposals. I mean, the last big one was in 2013. I think at this point, most of the base constituency, both in MAGA and of the Republican Party generally, are opposed to any kind of amnesty deal. But here's the thing, Jesse, these things take on a life of their own. Once they're put out there, there are a surprising amount of institutional players, of corporate organizations that give these kinds of things momentum. And I'll say, look, there's a good maybe 30 members of the Republican conference in the United States Senate who would support any amnesty deal, any amnesty deal at all that would come across their desks, they would vote for. So I think the unfortunate part of this kind of proposal, once it has the stamp of approval from some Republicans, is that it can really start to get its own momentum, and it could really gain some steam.
Okay, well, that's beyond horrifying. Let's move on to what we actually should be doing, and that's deporting people. Not just illegals, we should be denaturalizing people who are here. They lie to get into this country and then trash this country. How far away are we from actually doing things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're light years away from anything that would resemble mass deportations. Mass deportations is a cute slogan at this point. It's not been operationalized on the ground. I think Stephen Miller is doing his best both on the regulatory side to advance denaturalizations at USCIS and then to operationalize the arrest and the detainment and then eventual removal through ICE and CBP. But he's essentially fighting this conflict with one arm tied behind his back, because leading Republicans, both in the Senate and in governor's mansions across the country, don't want this happening. If you notice, Jesse, there have been so many operations to remove illegal aliens across the country, largely in blue states. Red states have, you know, pissed and moaned about any kind of worksite enforcement, whether it's in big ag or whether it's in retail operations or in anything related to the food industry, slaughterhouses, packing plants. So whole parts of this country have been essentially taken off the table for any kind of mass deportation operation. And I think the numbers that DHS continues to cite as the number of people who have self-deported are at this juncture at least unverified. There are a lot of interesting tools at the disposal currently for the incoming secretary, for Secretary Mullen, to use at DHS. And I think everyone's hope is that he's going to pick these legal equities, pick some of this tech, the technology stack that's been developed for DHS, and start wielding those to get some of these people out. The numbers are not where they're nowhere near where they need to be, not only for the year, but for this first quarter of 2026. And so I hope Secretary Mullen sees that and starts to run with it and really pick up the mantle here that was dropped last year.
Why was it dropped? Because it doesn't sound like you're blaming the left for this. I understand they have the judges, and I understand all that, but it doesn't sound like this is solely the responsibility of the left. It sounds like it's our fault?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I think it's a combination. I mean, the Democrats, though, as you and I think, would both acknowledge, Jesse, it was baked into the calculus, right? We knew all along that the Democrats would do everything they could to throw up obstacles to obstruct the ability of Republicans to carry out mass deportations. And that includes their overemphasis on selecting judges for the district courts where those injunctions would be handed down in the early stages of any proposed Trump plan for mass deportations. So the left in this country, their view on this whole subject was decided upon well in advance of President Trump even taking office in January of 2025. What's been surprising is the number of Republican governors, Republican state legislators, even Republican elected law enforcement, you know, sheriffs and big city police chiefs, who are supposedly supporters of law and order and have done everything they can to slow the progress of mass deportations. I know that's not something the administration wants to talk about publicly, because they're working overtime to get some of these folks on board and to create, you know, workable relationships, especially with local sheriffs and police chiefs. But the truth of the matter is, a lot of the sand in the gears of the mass deportation machine has come from elected Republicans.
Well, that's pretty much horrifying. That brings me to legal immigration. Republicans love this line. Well, we need high walls, but wide gates. I'm against illegal immigration, but legal immigration is wonderful. They love to give that speech over and over and over again. You hear that speech, but legal immigration is destroying this country. We are massively importing people, displacing Americans, driving up the cost, destroying our culture. Are we also light years away from tackling that problem?
You know, I'm actually a little bit more bullish on reforms to legal immigration than I am this sort of what's proving to be the intractable problem of illegal immigration. And having worked on this for President Trump in 45, I'll tell you, there's been just a sea change in opinion on the question of legal immigration. No, it's not showing up in the United States Senate. No, it doesn't show up in corporate boardrooms. No, it isn't the preferred talking point of most governors. But in the grassroots of the Republican Party, it is increasingly the case that most people see firsthand the social incohesion, the just deterioration of civic institutions that has come from essentially 40 years of mass immigration. I think more and more Americans are waking up to the reality that we have an assimilation crisis. If that's, I mean, that's really kind of like a generous term for it at this point. We have no assimilation. But the assimilation crisis is one that people are seeing in their hospitals, on mass transit systems across the country, in their kids' schools, in their playing fields, and in their own neighborhoods. And I think more and more Americans are saying, look, why do we have 126 different visa categories? Why do we have legal visa categories for ice dancers and cruise ship performers? We should simplify the system. We should narrow the aperture, and we should literally only be taking a handful of people every year who can make these world-class demonstrable contributions to science, technology, or our economy, if that. So I think more and more Americans are at the point where they say, what we need is a full moratorium, and we need a total freeze on mass immigration. And look, Jesse, as you've commented many times over the last few years, that's not without historical analog. I mean, this country, the boom of the mid-20th century economy in the United States, our growth as a technological superpower really grows out of the 1920s immigration work done by men like Henry Cabot Lodge. And that policy of restricting mass immigration allowed the country to cohere. It allowed for the re-emergence of civic institutions and to assimilate the millions of Irish and Italian immigrants that entered the country in the late 19th century. I think we're at that similar juncture again, where if we want to keep a country, a coherent country where we all can obey the same laws and row in the same direction economically, something similar is going to have to happen.
All right. I feel like we're progressing on the right. I have all the complaints in the world about the GOP, but I feel like we are taking some steps towards that. They may be baby steps, but when I see guys like Mitch McConnell and Tom Tillis retiring, I look at the future contenders in the GOP. Are we inching our way there?
Yeah, I think we are inching our way there. I mean, a great example of this is Brandon Gill in Texas. He is unabashed in his perspective that a number of legal visas, like the H-1B visa, have cannibalized the American workforce. They've depreciated the opportunities for young American workers entering into STEM, technology, or really any field where they went to college and graduated and are looking now to gain gainful employment. So I think Brandon Gill, folks like him, are the future of the party. The question now is, it's a foot race. Who gets there first? The millions upon hundreds of millions of immigrants who have come to this country through legal means, including, you know, the diversity lottery, which is 65,000 green cards we hand out every year to people who have no prior tie to the United States, no familiarity with our language, no understanding of our civics or our Constitution. Are they going to be the future of the country, or are American working men and women, our own citizens, going to be the future of the country? And really, honestly, we are so close to the final tipping point where there will be no coming back from it. I think that's the question, is if we're inching along with baby steps, are we actually going to get to the place where we can put a moratorium in place, we can reduce the overall flows and start to, again, encourage assimilation and some coherency to our civic institutions, creating an America for Americans once more.
Theo, how did we, I mean, I hate to ask for a history lesson, but how in the world do we get to a place where so much of this is done and it's legal? It's just crazy that the people I talk to that can't find jobs, their kids are graduating, they can't find jobs, and they're starting to wake up to the fact that the country's economy has just been handed over to foreigners, and they don't even understand how that happened. How did that happen? And it's legal. It's bonkers.
Yeah, and it's totally legal. I mean, in my own lifetime, this has been sort of the story of my family. I grew up in a working class family in one of the poorer parts of the United States. I will say that I grew up in a majority-minority city, the first majority-minority city in America. And my hometown was essentially the dumping ground of all kinds of streams of legal immigration. The Hmong, the Laotians, the Vietnamese from the Vietnam War, Grenadians from the Grenada conflict, Central Americans from our conflict with the Sandinistas, you name it. And so all of those people came in through the asylum process, through the refugee process, and they were placed in not the desirable communities in America. None of those folks from, you know, the boat people from Vietnam weren't being relocated to Beverly Hills or San Francisco. They were being dumped into communities that were already economically struggling, already struggling with those sort of socioeconomic indicators like college graduates per household, communicable disease, life expectancy, mortality, you name it. So that was our immigration system, again, under a Republican president in the 1980s, under President Reagan and then George H.W. Bush. It only compounded from that point forward. So the mass immigration that we see now is a byproduct of Reagan's amnesty in 1986. A lot of people don't realize that we are still, even today, seeing adjustments of status. That is, people who either were illegal or who had family who were on the other side in Mexico, who are even today claiming benefits under the 1986 Reagan amnesty. So it's not something that was done just in 1 year or 5 years. What we saw was a slow birth of mass immigration 10, 15, 20, 30 years forward. Add into that mix someone like President Obama, who had a decided view of what kinds of immigration streams should be privileged from which places in the world and where those immigrants should be located, i.e. the Twin Cities in Minnesota or in Portland, Maine. And the goal of immigration as a tool for creating reliant constituencies for the Democrat Party becomes very obvious circa 2009, 2010, 2011. So this has been a slow burn, Jesse, for a lot of the country. But in certain places, we saw the effects of mass immigration, the displacement of American workers, the cannibalization of our institutions, and really sort of the destruction of a civic American culture as early as 1984, 85, 86. So I realize a lot of Americans are just now waking up to this reality, but a lot of this has been in the pipeline and just sort of metastasizing throughout the country over the last 40 years.
Theo, where is Trump on all this personally? I'm fully aware that he's nowhere close to being as radicalized as I am on this issue. I got that, and I don't expect that from him. I want him to get the ball rolling, then the next guy can keep it rolling. Where is he on this?
I mean, I think the president generally is supportive of the notion that America needs a coherent American culture. We need institutions that allow our citizens to participate in government, in the economy. I don't think it's fair to say that the president no longer cares about the American worker. The president, that is bread and butter, a first principle for the president that has never changed. I do also think that the president is supportive of an immigration architecture, if you'll call it that, that would simplify the system, make it easier for talented individuals to come into the United States. That's still his view. Now, whether that's compatible with the view of most Republican senators or most Republican governors or most of the corporate oligarchs in Silicon Valley and throughout the rest of the U.S. Economy, I don't think so. I think they have a decidedly more liberal, more open borders view. And so I think a lot of the president's subtleties on this question get washed out by certain members of the Republican Party in the Senate or certain corporate leaders in Silicon Valley. I will say one other thing. The president has always felt very strongly that the laws that we have need to be enforced. And for anyone who wants a casual reading assignment for the weekend, go get yourself a copy of the Immigration and Naturalization Act. And you will see law after law after law that in your own community, in your own neighborhood, you can easily detect is not being enforced. And so I think the president is right to put a heavy emphasis on this idea that, look, we have laws. We should be giving resources to the men and women at ICE and CBP to enforce those laws. Let's start with that and then talk about a reform or improving the way our immigration system works for those who are talented or the Albert Einstein genius located somewhere in Europe. That the first principle should be, let's simplify the enforcement of our existing laws first. I think that's where the president generally is at.
Theo, the last one from me. Is it time for Alito to retire? As much as I love the man, that's certainly no disrespect, but I know which way the political winds are blowing. Is it time for him to go?
Yeah, look, Jesse, I've got a decided view on this question. My wife clerked for Justice Alito. We love the man. He is a tremendous American hero. I think that's like the starting point of any discussion about Justice Alito. They don't make him like this guy anymore. And I think that's really the big problem, Jesse, is no one has pointed out to me, and I've been in the conservative legal movement, whatever that is, for years, no one has pointed out to me how we have improved our judicial selection process. We still select for, I think, outdated, outmoded characteristics. How are you on this procedural nicety? What is your subtle sort of theory of interpretation? And you have to remember, Jesse, Justice Alito himself is sort of a mistake, right? I mean, the Bushies wanted Harriet Myers. They wanted this milquetoast moderate insider who had been advising George W. Bush for decades. She had no decided views on abortion, no decided views on the deep state or administrative power. And when that blew up in their face, they had to tack right to mollify the Republican base. And so they ended up with someone like Justice Alito. The point of that is just to say, I don't think we've changed, we've improved our ability to select judges or justices since that 2005 disaster. And so I put me in squarely in the camp of someone who says, Justice Alito is a great American, he's a great jurist, and there's no indication that we're able to find anyone like him on the horizon. So better to stick with the horse who got us here than go and pick some kind of random donkey off of the lot and hope that they turn out to be a racehorse as well.
That's good enough for me. Theo, thank you, brother. I appreciate it. We'll talk the economy. Time to talk about that. It's kind of important. Carol Roth next. Before we talk to Carol Roth, how'd you sleep last night? How'd you wake up this morning? Did you wake up this morning? Oh, man, it was a bad night's sleep. Tossing and turning. Maybe your eyes felt like sandpaper. And you're thinking to yourself, today's gonna suck. I slept like a baby. Because I had a cup of hot chocolate before bed. Dream powder from Beam. Has all kinds of natural things in it. You'd never know. It's just a delicious cup of hot chocolate, but has all these natural things in it. You just kind of get a little sleepy and drift off to sleep. Because it's natural, you wake up the next day ready to roll. Shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. We'll be back.
Is that if you go back before the 20th century, there were no income taxes, there were no regulations on business, you could earn as much money as you want, leave 100% of it to your children with no taxes.
Right.
That's the world they want back. And to get it back, they need society to change. They need people to be less modern. They need people to want fewer things.
I love it. It's wild. I've said this before. On so many issues, the communists actually express exactly what I want better than the Republicans do. Joining me now, the great Carol Roth, 2 times New York Times bestseller, recovering former investment banker. Carol, Joy Reid and me, we see eye to eye on things.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds amazing. Where is this utopia that she described? Wait, you mean that you get to earn as much as you want and you get to keep it? That is such a radical idea. You know, Jesse, I am 100% certain that Joy Reid was a kid who liked group projects in school. She let one or two other people do all of the work and just absolutely free rode on what everybody did. Because that's what communists do. They like group projects. And if you are a kid that likes a group project, you're going to grow up to be a commie. And I would be willing to stake lots of money that Joy Reid liked those group projects.
You're so right about that. And along those lines, of course, Elizabeth Warren's pushing a wealth tax and things like that. And it's so obvious at this point that they're all just thieves, Carol. They're just dirty thieves in the end. And they can use whatever flowery language and sound as nice as humanly possible, but they're just a bunch of filthy thieves, aren't they?
Dirty, greedy, communist thieves, which in many cases is redundant, but I'm just going to say it again for effect. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is presiding, and I use the word preside in the colloquial sense. Yes, I know she's not the president, for those of you who are slow, but she sits as part of Congress over a budget, right? And they take in from us every year, Jesse Kelly, $5 trillion. $5 trillion, that is more than the GDP of every country in the entire world, the output of every country in the entire world, except for the US and China. So they are taking from us the output foot of every country in the world, any single country you pick, more than that, and still cannot meet the budget. They're still adding to the debt. Under the time that Elizabeth Warren has been in Congress, we've added $20 trillion to our national debt from deficit. So because she cannot do her job, she's coming out and she's saying, you know, I need more money to keep myself in power. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to steal from you. I'm going to steal a stake in Jeff Bezos's company. It's bad enough if it were cash, but we all know that Jeff Bezos is not Scrooge McDuck, that he does not have a coin room that he's swimming around in, that he owns a company that's valuable. So the only way to take, quote unquote, this wealth from him is to make him sell a share of the company he built to fund the fact that Elizabeth Warren is a dirty, greedy communist. And that's just not right.
That is just not right. Carol, high gas prices aren't right either. Now, Donald Trump's excellent on things like energy, expanding, drilling, things like that. So if we're energy independent, we have a president who's good at that stuff, why are gas prices so high and when are they coming down?
All right, so the energy independence that we have in the U.S. is sort of like being energy independent on paper. And I'm going to use an analogy. I'm not sure, Jesse, are you a baker or do you just like to eat baked goods?
No, I have a wife for that. I just eat whatever okay. She makes.
All right, so I'm just going to go with something that your wife might do. So let's say your wife and I, we need to make 100 pies, right? And we need 8 apples per pie. So we're going to need 800 apples. If somebody comes and delivers us 800 apples, can we make the 100 pies? Well, you might say yes right out of the box, but the answer is not that easy because, you know, we may get the good ones, the Granny Smith and the Honeycrisp that we can use in the pies, but we may get some Red Delicious, which really aren't delicious. It's a complete lie of a name and they're disgusting and shouldn't be used for anything, but definitely not in a pie. You never want to put that in a pie. So the reality is if half of the apples are Red Delicious, then we don't have enough to bake our pies, even though theoretically we have 800 apples. And it's the same thing that happens with gas. There are different kinds of gas. There are different grades. There are different characteristics. There is light and sweet. There is heavy and sour. And so we produce certain types, particularly on the light and sweet side, but our refining capabilities are set up more efficiently to process other kinds, the heavier and the sour. And so there's a mismatch. So that's why we can be producing so much of this oil and gas, why we can be refining so much. We can be exporting, but also importing. So that's kind of the first piece of it. And the second problem that we have is that oil is a commodity that is priced globally. So if it's expensive somewhere else in the world and it's cheaper here, they're going to factor in what's the cost of transportation. And if it's still cheaper here, they're going to start to bid up the cost of the oil and gas that's coming from the United States. So because of that, because we have global price commodity, because we have these very specific needs of refiners, the consumer ends up unfortunately paying for both, and that's why you end up paying more not only at the pump, but as it, no pun intended, flows through the economy to 6,000 derivative products, impacts logistics and everything else, it ends up coming out of your pocket. That's always the case, right?
Carol, I hate to nail down on such a nerdy detail, but I just want to rewind for a second. Did you basically just say that our refining capability is designed for oil we don't have? How did that, what?
Yeah, so, you mean, obviously things shift over time, and it's not to say that we couldn't necessarily change that around, but it's set up to most efficiently produced more of the type that we don't have than the type that we do have. And it would take a lot of investment and time to change that around. So I would imagine over time, there will be a better match as, you know, investments are made and there's a higher time horizon, but it's not like the kind of thing, you know, that you would see in the Flintstones where they could just like, you know, change everything around really quickly. And by the way, Jesse, just to establish my credibility on the subject, in addition to being a business and a financial and economic expert, I did see both seasons of Landman in full. So I do know what I'm talking about here.
Well, clearly. Yeah. Carol, what's wrong with the economy? I know that everybody likes to put out the numbers or the unemployment, but Carol, I don't know a single person who says it's good. The job market sucks. The economy feels crappy. Why can't we fix it?
So, you know, it depends on who you are and what lens you're looking through. And this is, I think, the frustration for so many Americans, because if you pull out and you look at everything in the aggregate and you look at the macro, if you believe the jobs numbers and the numbers of jobs that were created last month, which, by the way, I don't believe, but if you do, things look pretty good. The unemployment rate still looks pretty good. We are still growing, but it's coming in certain areas. So unfortunately, what these big macro numbers don't do is look at what's going on an individual basis. And for the wealthiest Americans who have benefited, other than obviously in the past month with all the conflict in Iran affecting the stock market, but have generally over years and years participated in a higher stock market, higher housing prices, you know, they are feeling pretty good. Their jobs may be more solid. They are spending and they are carrying a large part of the economy. For people who don't have as much access to that, they do feel like they're struggling because we have been through so much inflation. The costs of everything have gone through the roof. Wages have not kept up. And so people are still treading water. So you really do need to look, you know, on an individual basis. And I think it's unfair when you get these, you know, economists and muckety-mucks saying, oh, but, you know, look at how great the economy is, and you're feeling very different. And obviously that's, you know, been the outgrowth of 15 years of policy. It's not anything that's just happened. It's the tail end that what we're feeling from all of this policy that's been developed, you know, particularly over the last decade and a half. And, you know, this is why President Trump was put in office. He was put in office to help with affordability, to make homes more affordable, to make, you know, gas and food more affordable. And I think that's why when you see him go off on what I like to refer to as side quests in video games, instead of just, you know, focusing on the main task that everybody was hoping he'd focus on, I think that's why there are a lot of Americans who may be happy with what some of President Trump is doing, but still frustrated that the area that they wanted him to focus on the most doesn't seem to be the one that is front and center.
If he starts focusing on it, like now, can we get this thing turned around?
So I do believe he will start focusing on it as we get closer to the midterms. I certainly think that is going to be what everybody is telling him inside his administration and outside. And, you know, the question of turning it around, I think it's a very, very large boat. And so, you know, right now we have to stop the water from coming in before we can focus on turning it around. So I do think there are things that can be done to make things better for some period of time. But there are larger structural issues that are going to make it very difficult to turn the boat around. Again, it is something that we can do, although I don't believe we have the political will to do it. So, but what I will say about it, you know, if you go back and you look throughout history, you know, empires can take a very long time to come to a logical conclusion. So even if you believe we're at that end of empire stage, it doesn't mean that, you know, it happens in a year or 10 years or even 20 years. We don't know. That's the most frustrating thing, is we don't know the timeline. We can see the trajectory, and it's something that could happen quickly, and it's something that could take a long time. So it's why, as you're setting up your future, whether it's your portfolio, whether it's thinking ahead to, you know, what your kids are going to be doing, you have to plan for a lot of different outcomes and diversify, because we know what the options are. We just never know how long it's going to take to get there.
Carol, thanks for making us smarter. I'll talk to you soon. Well, that's why you need to switch to Pure Talk. Save money. Look, it's not just that Pure Talk hires Americans. Verizon doesn't do that. AT&T doesn't do that. T-Mobile doesn't do that, sending more American jobs overseas. Pure Talk hires Americans. Pure Talk's on the same towers. You don't have to sit and stress about service. It's easy to switch. Keep your phone. You can get a new phone, by the way. They have those, but you can just keep your phone you have. Keep your phone number. You save money. We're talking plans for like $35 a month. $35. What are you paying right now for your talk, text, data on your phone? Switch to Pure Talk, and then you can feel good about paying your bills, and the bill goes down. You want to beat inflation? Save some money. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. Lighten the mood next. All right, it's time to lighten the mood. And I told you when Joe Biden was president, it's not like I informed you of this, you already knew, but we forget sometimes that when the United States president speaks, it's not just us who pay attention. The whole world watches when the president speaks. And as an American, we can't relate to that because we don't care what anyone else says. We don't pay attention. You don't know the sound, probably, of the UK PM. You probably don't know the sound of his voice. And that would be one you would know. You don't know. Everyone knows what Trump sounds like. Everyone knew what Joe Biden sounded like. And they all came to conclusions when Joe Biden would speak publicly. And Donald Trump got up and he laid out there what Kim Jong-un thought about him.
To protect us from Kim Jong-un, who I get along with very well, as you know. Do you notice he said very nice things about me? He used to call Joe Biden a mentally retarded person, okay?
So, that happened. And look, Kim has cable TV. He saw when Joe would get up there and do this stuff.
The beer brewed here, it is used to make the brew beer in this refinery. Oh, Earth Rider, thanks for the Great Lake.
I'll see you tomorrow.